talk, Tim, about, we've already mentioned a few of them. We mentioned the Fairports debut album being this year. We mentioned the Joni album being this year. Let's just quickly run down some of the other sort of debut albums this year. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of albums this year that were the debut albums by artists that went on to much, much greater things. So I don't think we should dwell too much on any of these, but other notable debuts this year: James Taylor, Keith Jarrett, Status Quo, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Jeff Beck, Isaac Hayes, David Ackles, Aphrodite's Child, Neil Young's first album. I love that record, but
I really like that. Yeah, that's one of those albums that gets unfairly criticised
because of what came after.
But actually, I possibly prefer it.
If you follow that album with Everyone Knows This Is Nowhere, after the Gold Rush and Harvest, it's going to be overlooked. But I agree. I love it. I think
isn't that the one with Nietzsche arrangements?
That Jack Nietzsche. Yeah.
And they are. Again, it's got that kind of Baroque sensibility, which puts it in 1968. It's a Baroque singer-songwriter album. But the one thing that Neil Young has become known for is that kind of In a Gadda Da Vida-style simplicity that, you know, he'll just pummel those three chords, whether softly or loudly, throughout the piece. But actually, on his debut album, and some of his writing for Buffalo Springfield, he's a really good musician.
Well, but and to be fair, he did keep that up through his career. You're right, they're the less lauded albums. But an album like Comes a Time from 78, for example, it's incredibly lush, very soft rock. It came out in the slipstream of an album like Rumours. It fits right in with that kind of vibe of Rumours. But yes, he's always had through his career these, what you might call more middle of the road albums, more middle of the road moments. This is one of them. I'm not sure how he looks on it now. I don't think he particularly rates it very highly himself, as I understand it. But I'm like you. I think it's not one of my favourite Neil Young albums.
But it's definitely in my upper half of Neil Young
albums. Yeah, I agree. It would be in my. It would probably scrape into my top 10 Neil Young albums. It's a very auspicious debut album. Unlike, not everyone had an auspicious beginning to their career. Let's talk about The Cheerful Insanity of Giles and Fripp. This, it's quite a sweet record, isn't it? Couldn't be further away from the intensity of In the Court of the Crimson King, could it? Which would be the following year. This is an album that probably is a little bit of a sort of English psychedelic curiosity nowadays, isn't it? I think for years it wasn't even available, was it?
Yeah.
I mean, it was something that people searched out if they were big Crimson Fripp fans. They would search out this album and then be surprised by this very sweet, very whimsical. I mean, does it stand up, Tim? Is it just a curiosity?
More curiosity. You know, when we're saying about, you know, Joni Mitchell and Bowie, because Bowie's debut is similarly whimsical and bonkers, but I think there's enough there for it still to be a classic of its kind. I'm not sure this is a classic of its kind, and what makes it remarkable is obviously what followed it. You know, In the Court of the Crimson King is in a different universe.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And the fact that that masterpiece sprung from this band not so long before.
Although, to be fair, there's a couple of tracks at the end where you can go, with the benefit of hindsight.
Is it Erudite Eyes?
Yes, and I think there's another track which is an instrumental, is it? I have been
years since I remember. Yes, right, the instrumental suite.
And I think it's written by Fripp, the one I'm thinking of. There's a couple of tracks right at the end where, with the benefit of hindsight, and I realise this is the big caveat, with the benefit of hindsight, you can kind of hear the origins
of some
of what was to come.
Yeah.
But yes, in turn, the leap from this album to In the Court of the Crimson King is substantial, to say the least.
Yeah.
Also this year, Tentative Beginnings. I'm not a big fan of these records. I think you are, Tim. The first two Deep Purple albums. You seem to quite like these, don't you?
I do, yeah. My favourite Deep Purple albums are the first three Deep Purple albums.
Yeah, see, I'm not a fan of those records. I don't particularly like the singer at this time. And I think they're finding their way. They're finding the Deep Purple sound.
Yeah.
And of course, interestingly enough, one of the other albums they made in the early years was the album of the classical composition, the Concerto for Group and Orchestra. I think there's a sense that Deep Purple, for the first four albums, were just trying all these different things, throwing stuff at the wall.
I think they were doing it well. I mean, I particularly like the album from 69, which I think is the self-titled Deep Purple, where they cover Donovan, don't they? They do Lumia.
Yeah, The Don.
The second
artist to cover Donovan on this list.
He could be another Game.
Yeah.
Artist. But yeah, so I particularly like that. But I think, you know, Hush is a great single.
It is.
They're a fantastic group. Again, you can tell there are really interesting players here, though they're not doing their patented heavy rock sound. Weirdly, and you could hear it because I think it was covered during the early 90s, there's a sense of baggy Manchester in some of the groove pieces, because they're kind of drawing slightly from R&B, the heavy organ. I'm thinking in Spiral Carpets even. Well, I can hear that early Deep Purple sound in early, late 80s, early 90s Manchester bands.
Well, but I think Deep Purple always had a very strong element of funk and groove.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what set them apart in a way, along with Led Zeppelin. They both had that kind of incredible sense of groove and funk. Fireball, my favourite Deep Purple album, has got a very strong element of funk on it and groove.
I'll tell you one thing I'd concede is that there's an element to some of this when they're grooving. That, do you remember that music you used to get in the Odeon cinemas between the adverts?
Vaguely.
Or even in the adverts.
Okay,
You know, welcome to Batley Carpets.
Oh, yes.
There's a sort of aspect that era of Deep Purple could have produced the soundtrack for it. Because they were still having those adverts in the early 80s, certainly in the Warrington Odeon.
But also just the sheer reliance on the amount of cover versions they're doing again at this point in their career.
Yeah.
So I think this is a band that certainly took time, unlike Neil Young, who we think was out of the gate, was just making great
records. I think he was, Mitchell was, Young was.
Deep Purple, for me, weren't. They weren't.
They weren't, though. I like those albums because they're all potential.
Yeah,
I know, I might go with you. Fireball might be my favourite, but the self-titled third album is almost up there.
Randy Newman's debut album, another artist we've mentioned a lot on the show. I'm not particularly knowledgeable about Randy Newman. You're our resident Randy Newman expert. How is his debut album on a
scale?
He's
like Neil Young, like Joni Mitchell. He's just out there.
He's out of the gate,
himself.
Is he?
He's out of the gate.
He's out of the gate.
I think it's great. Though he doesn't like it and some fans don't like it because it suffers from that 60s orchestral over-arrangement.
Okay.
I really like it. And I think some of the songs it favours with the orchestral over-arrangement. But yeah, you know, his opening track, Love Story, it's this very brief piece that tells the story of a relationship up to having children, up to them dying in a home in Florida. In a short pop piece. And he also, like a lot of artists during this era, he's drawing from music from the 1910s, 1920s. There's also kind of a Ray Charles element from the 50s. But he's, unlike anybody, these exquisite miniatures, you know, things like Cowboy and I Think It's Going to Rain Today remain amongst my favourite tracks of all time. His voice is there, his writing is there, his piano style is there.
From what little I know, he's almost got that sense of the American short story about him, hasn't he? Almost like a Raymond Carver song, a Raymond Carver story. And I do like that very much about him. But again, another outlier, another maverick, another person that's really hard
completely
to categorise, isn't he?
Yeah, where do you put it?
Yeah.
But again, he was one of those artists that was already being covered by others.
Right.
And in fact, you know, I realised that I knew him as a kid. I heard, you know, I think it was Simon Smith's Amazing Dancing Bear, which was a huge hit for, was it Alan Price?
I
loved when I was tiny. And then equally, my dad had this album of Neil Diamond covers and he was singing. So I was only about 8 or 9, but he was doing covers by people like Joni Mitchell, Randy Newman. It was the first time I ever heard those songs. And it was the only Neil Diamond album I liked because of the quality of the lyrics and those songs.
Right. Progressive undercurrents. So we're still a couple of years out, really, from the real explosion of so-called progressive rock. Well, in fact, at least a year out, if you make the argument that In the Court of the Crimson King is the real opening salvo of progressive rock. And of course, there's always the arguments that Moody Blues, Days of Future Past, in fact, Moody Blues made a great record this year too, which we'll talk about. Progressive undercurrent. So we're not quite yet in the thick of progressive conceptual music, but the roots are here in this year's music made by some of these artists. Let's talk about my favourite band of all time, Pink Floyd, Source Full of Secrets.
Really?
There are some days when I might say this is my favourite Pink Floyd record. There are other days I'll say Animals. There are other days I'll say Amagama. There's something, and I know that this is Nick Mason's favourite Pink Floyd record as well. There is something about the fusion of psychedelic production techniques with experimental music, you know, elements in certainly in the title track on Source Full of Secrets. No one else was attempting anything this experimental in pop music other than perhaps the Beatles with a track like Revolution 9 on the White Album, which I don't think is very good. I think Revolution 9, I know we said we were going to talk about the White Album. Revolution 9 for me is an example of something done a lot better by serious classical
music. I would agree, whereas Blackbird is a supreme example of its form.
Agree. What do you think about the new Beyoncé version of Blackbird? Have you heard it?
I've not heard it yet, no. Do you like it?
It's all right. She's basically used the original backing track.
Oh, okay.
Which I'm presuming Macca has given her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's done her own vocal and she's kind of added lots of harmony. It's listen.
It's a brilliant song.
You cannot hurt that song. It's it's bulletproof, as they say. Anyway, but there's so much more on this record. You know, Set the Controls to the Heart of the Sun, amazing song. Remember a Day, we talked about that sense of nostalgia that a lot of music seems to have at this point, sense of tapping back into this sort of feeling of childhood. This Rick Wright song is so beautiful. Corporal Clegg, which you mentioned earlier, a brilliant piece of experimental psychedelic pop, which still sounds right up there to this day to me, with
but
all the best examples of the genre.
Floyd with comedy in that one, the kazoo break.
Yeah, absolutely.
In it.
And then finishing with this extraordinary Syd Barrett, I mean, Jug Band Blues. You know, we talked about how the Incredible String Band were having a big influence on the way people were writing music at this time. I wonder if Syd listened to the Incredible String Band, because it's got that sense of being these little fragments that are strung together with almost this kind of sense of dream logic. Psychedelic dream. And then the idea that he would get the sort of Salvation Army band in the middle.
I thought that was a bit Charles Ives-ish. Remember the Charles Ives composition where he'd written something where he'd heard two brass bands going down a street.
Oh, wow.
And there was a collision between the pieces. So he wrote a symphony based on this collision he heard in his head. And I kind of hear that in the Syd Barrett composition here towards the end. But yeah, no, I think it's a wonderful album. And funnily enough, I'm sorry, as I was playing it today to refresh my mind of this album, which I've always liked, I was going past one of Nick Mason's houses, because he's got one of his main houses is about 15 minutes from where I live. So as I was going past it, Sourceful of Secrets.
Good soundtrack
to going past the house.
Nick might have had his window open and he heard you listening, so he'd have been happy.
He was in a two up, two down.
He'd been happy because he likes that album. But I mean, Syd's lyric, I just think in some ways he tapped into the psychedelic spirit in a way that just felt completely natural and not self-conscious.
Yeah.
See, we talked about a lot of the psychedelic music. A lot of it does seem very much like posturing, very self-conscious.
Yes.
And with Syd, it never feels like that. Mm. And it feels like it is somehow reflecting his very soul, if I can be pretentious about this. So, you know, the opening salvo to Jug Band, it's awfully considerate of you to think of me here, and I'm most obliged to you for making it clear that I'm not here. And then the way the record ends,
it's devastating.
The sea isn't green and I love the queen, and what exactly is a dream and what exactly is a joke? And the fact that that is the end of Syd Barrett's tenure in Pink Floyd.
When I was listening to that today, I thought, actually, I wish he'd never done anything after that. I like some of the solo work.
Me too. Wow, Madcap.
I really like it. Yeah, but I think what an ending to a career this would have been. And I think the thing is, once more, it has almost, as you say, this kind of the collision of the Salvation Army playing randomly, and then this beautiful acoustic strum and him with this disconsolate voice.
The voice.
And that lyric. It's great. And of course, it's the only track that he writes on it, isn't it?
Well, he's on three songs on this record, but you only really hear him. You hear him doing the slide on Remember a Day. You don't really hear him on Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun, although apparently it was recorded during a session when he was in the band. And then Jug Band Blues is essentially a solo piece.
I mean, it's great. But what I thought was interesting about it was just how seamless it is, that basically it fits from the end of Piper. You know, this is a logical continuation of Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And yet, you also have hints of where Pink Floyd will be six years from now. Because actually, Corporal Clegg, which is probably my least favourite track on it, there's the Gilmour refrain, the Gilmour sung refrain, which could be a Gilmour sung refrain on Dark Side of the Moon or Wish You Were Here. Yeah. That's in the mix somehow. That's got that kind of, as we say, that kind of Hendrix energy of the era, but it comes out of Piper at the Gates of Dawn. As you say, it has this music, contemporary classical, which is beyond anybody at that stage, hints at where I think a lot of Berlin music's going, especially Tangerine Dream
in their early
days. You know, you can hear so many bands. Then you've also got the template for indie in Set the Controls to the Heart of the Sun. There's still a
kind of
shoegaze quality. There's also kind of a punkish energy in that piece. Mm. And the opening of the album as well, I think.
Let There Be More Light. Yeah, very muscular, sort of almost proto-heavy rock. Yeah. And Gilmour's voice, you know, just completes the sound of the band, doesn't it? I mean, he's just such a great voice, great, and the guitar playing. So much as I love Sid, there's no doubt that Gilmore... No,
well, I think Richard Wright is the voice that's probably closest to Sid Barrett, I think. And once more, his compositions on this album...
Brilliant, yeah.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, but again, both very nostalgic for childhood.
Yeah.
Seesaw and Remember a Day. And, you know, all his songs were like this. On the next, on Atom Heart Mother, you've got Summer of 68. Again, yeah. Another nostalgic song. He's always got the sense of nostalgia for childhood
and
too.
And that fits into that. Barrett. That's what I mean.
Exactly,
that's,
yes.
His yeah. voice is similar and yeah. his preoccupations yes. are similar. I love him, you know, yeah. So any of them could have actually been the lead vocalist and taken this band. But what I'm amazed at is how it seems like a natural progression and yet hints at myriad possibilities.
Yeah. It's, I mean, on the surface of it, it's a very schizophrenic record.
Yeah.
But actually, it does hang together because there's a Floydiness. And maybe it's something we're just looking at it through with the benefit of hindsight. There's a Floydiness that goes through all of it, from the serious music concrete of Sourceful of Secrets to the jug band, you know, the Salvation Army band on Jug Band Blues. There's a searching curiosity about the possibilities of music. And of course, the, you know, they were making this in the slipstream of having lost their yeah. primary singer, songwriter, you know, focal point. And by all accounts, they were kind of flailing at the time. And yet they produced this master, to me,
yeah, yeah.
No, a psychedelic masterpiece.
And so many lovely echoes of the future, like the organ, you know, part of the reason why Sourceful of Secrets works for me as a track is because it resolves so beautifully. Yeah, yeah. And you can hear that trick used in Cirrus Minor, which is one of my favourite Floyd pieces.
You, yeah.
And also you can hear those chords and that stateliness as a part of Atom Heart Mother.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many future echoes, and maybe even as well, because I suspect Wright wrote those chords. You can hear it in Dark Side as well. Great Gig in the Sky. There's something of that elegiac quality. But as we've said before as well, there is humour in this album. There's silliness.
Yeah, Corporal Clegg. Yeah, yeah. And Jug Band Blues, the Salvation Army. Although ultimately the lyrics kind of offset the you know, the playfulness of the music and give it a gravitas that I can't think of many other artists that could have pulled that off other than Sid at that time, you know. But there's something about this, there's a sense of otherness about the record as well. I can't tell you how they made some of those sounds. You know, on things like Corporal Clegg and Sourceful Secrets, there's still a sense, how did they make those sounds? They still sound like nothing else I've ever heard on a, you know, on a psychedelic or on any record, you know. So for that reason, I think it is on, you know, on the right day, it is my favourite Floyd record because, as you say, it has everything they're going to become, but it still has the sense of playfulness and whimsy from the Sid era. Sid is still there, but Gilmore is there too.
And with that devastating ending, it has a seriousness that any, you know, the most serious Pink Floyd final cut possesses. Yeah. It's got something again that's a kind of an echo of the future. And it was the first artwork for Hypnosis as well, wasn't it?
I think you might be right, yeah, because he was a school friend, wasn't he?
And Storm, that ties in as well. There's something about the kind of murky, dreamlike quality of the cover that again draws you in.
Don't expect any negativity about Pink Floyd on this podcast, folks. Yeah, we in love them. Right, other progressive undercurrents. So we have that, again, this is another album that could have easily been in the tentative beginnings category. Soft Machine's first album. It's not my favourite Soft Machine album. It's the one that's closest to psychedelic pop.
Yeah.
I think very quickly within the space of two albums, they're going to become something completely different. They're going to go down that jazz route, jazz rock. Here, they're still making something very much of its time, isn't it? And clearly, it wasn't where their hearts really lay. And it's a good record. It's a good record.
I really like it.
It's a good record,
And it does fly off at tangents. I think there are quite a lot of instrumental pieces, a lot of the pieces bursting at the seams.
Yeah.
You do kind of get that impression, listening to both the Floyd and the Soft Machine, and to an extent the Caravan album that we'll probably discuss, you can hear how exciting it would have been to have been at one of those underground nights in 66, 67, 68 as these bands are emerging with those light shows. I think it still possesses a quality of that. I mean, I really like it.
I like it. Don't get me wrong. I do like it.
From the opening, you said you hated it.
It is my least favourite of the early Soft Machine.
From the opening seconds, Robert Wyatt is Robert
Wyatt.
Yeah,
absolutely.
His
voice
is there.
Yeah,
and he's, again, he's not just sing, because he's got a kind of slightly more R&B flavoured pop quality in his voice on this album, but he's still improvising with loops or
and he's still
echoes
doing,
and
Kevin Ayers is Kevin Ayers from the word go as well.
Yeah,
I suppose
yeah.
the only person that isn't himself from the word go is Mike Ratledge.
To an extent,
yeah.
I mean, I really like it. I mean, the first two albums, strangely, might be my favourite, along with 7. Strangely, of my Soft Machine albums, I really like these first two because again, it's almost all potential. That there's there are so many ideas, and as with the Floyd, it's very experimental, yet very sweet pop sensibility is also underpinning it. You can hear that Robert Wyatt has listened to Diana Ross and the Supremes and the Beatles, as well as trying to tear at the seams of the music.
I really like the second one. The second one for me is a big step on.
Yeah, I love the second one.
But then third for me is, as with a lot of people, third would be the one I would consider to be the, the classic. Another album that could easily have been in the tentative beginnings, Caravan's self-titled debut album. Although I don't think it's that tentative. I think they come out of the gate as Caravan.
They are fully there, and it might be my favourite Caravan album.
You're the second person that said that to me in the last few weeks. My friend Nigel also began. Okay. So it's his favourite Caravan album as well. I absolutely love it. They're completely Caravan from the word go. Well, it's the beginnings of something that will become known, I suppose, as the Canterbury sound, along with the Soft Machine. Richard Sinclair, we love Richard Sinclair's voice, don't we? I mean, that's the other thing.
Pie as well.
Pie as well. We love his voice. Wonderful voice. Quintessentially English, isn't it?
Yeah.
So English.
And it's ambitious. This is the thing that both the Soft Machine and the Caravan albums, they are very ambitious in parts. Mm. This is it. They don't forgo experiment, and they don't forgo immersing themselves in a pop sensibility, and that's why they both work.
Some great pop songs on this record. Place of My Own
is amazing.
What a great song. So we love the Caravan debut album. Another album that could have been in the tentative beginnings, although again I don't think it's tentative, the first Family album, Music in a Doll's House. It's kind of the anomaly in their catalogue because it's the album that kind of nods to Carnaby Street, psychedelia, baroque pop. There's a lot of string arrangements. Family later on became a little bit more muscular, a little bit more rock, no less ambitious, but this record has got some gorgeous baroque string arrangements, and Roger Chapman perhaps hasn't become quite as, you know, unique in his vocal styling. It's kind of reining in it a little bit here. One of the most extraordinary, along with Robin Gibb, actually, I see a strong connection between Robin Gibb vocal delivery and Roger Chapman's vocal delivery. The use of vibrato, almost a beautiful ugly kind of quality to their voices.
Bolan had it to an extent as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, I call it the Larry the Lamb effect.
Larry the Lamb. Well, you were not the first person to describe Bolan as Larry. People were doing it at the time. They were describing as Larry the Lamb. Some beautiful songs on this record, and very psychedelic production, very much of its era in that sense. But I could certainly understand why this would be someone's favourite Family record.
Again, it might be, along with Bandstand. I love Bandstand, actually. Yeah, but this as well. Really unpredictable arrangements. Again, it's almost got that. I'm thinking of William Burroughs' Cut Up. There's a sense of this album that it's all over the place.
Yeah.
That almost somebody has cut up three different albums to make this.
Yeah,
fully formed.
Fully formed. And a band that, again, perhaps have been a little bit forgotten. In the sort of scheme of things, I think there was a point where Family were right up there with your Floyds and your Soft Machines,
and they had a great sound and a great vocalist and the odd hit. I mean,
great songwriters,
you know,
Roger Chapman and John Whitney, some fantastic, a great songwriting duo.
Yeah, my friend the Sun, obviously.
Beautiful.
But you know, Burlesque, what a fantastic, almost that to me was doing the Stones and the Faces better than the Stones and the Faces. They could also do that earthy glam pop hit very well.
And they were great live by all accounts. But they broke up in 73, I want to say.
It's Only a Movie was the last one, wasn't it?
I think maybe they ran out a little bit of steam in the end, but incredibly prolific. Anyway, this is the debut record, and I'd say it's a classic. Another album that was a debut. In fact, they made two records this year, The Nice, The Thoughts of Erminus Dabjack, The Nice, which is very much, again, psychedelic pop.
Yeah.
Pretty much from beginning to end. And then later on in the year, they made the album Ars Longa Vita Brevis, which I think means art is long, life is short in Latin. And it's the beginnings of Keith Emerson's attempts to, the second album I'm talking about, the beginning of his attempts to fuse classical and pop music. I don't think it works at this point. I think he gets it right later on with Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Yeah.
It's a very badly produced record, which doesn't help. It sounds like it was very rushed. But I do love the earlier album, The Thoughts of Erminus Dabjack. I think that's another classic of the psychedelic pop era. What do you think, Tim?
Well, I think Emerson is pretty much there from the second album. You know, as a stylist, you can hear him. You know, he's got his sound, he's got his showmanship. What I'm saying is, as a talent, he's kind of there.
Yes.
It's not being perhaps realised to its best degree.
I suppose maybe that's the problem, that he didn't have the musicians around him to be able to sort of keep up with him at this point.
But it has a quality, you know. And again, I'm familiar with the Nice material in the sense that I would have heard everything they've done 3 to 4 times and so on, but not overly familiar. But I know of one producer who I won't name, who idolises the Nice, King Crimson, Egg, thinks ELP are the worst band that ever existed.
Wow. You have to tell me who that is off mic. Yeah. Well, I mean, the first Nice album is a classic, but it has no relationship at all to pretty much anything else the Nice did in their short period.
Well, they started
off
as a backing band for P.P. Arnold, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then it has absolutely nothing to do with what Emerson, Lake and Palmer did. You know, it is very, again, very much of its era. And the vocals are whimsical and very tongue-in-cheek. But it's good. It's good psychedelic pop. It's very good psychedelic pop. So I rate that album, but not the follow-up version. I did listen to it yesterday. But, again, with the benefit of hindsight, knowing what was to come, you can see how it was a very important stepping stone.
I mean, the thing is with Nice, it's never grabbed me. And again, I know that they were a huge influence on Genesis because the track The Knife famously was called The Nice. They used to go and see The Nice play. And I think that particularly Banks and Gabriel were in awe of it.
Right.
And that was meant to be their Nice tribute, but they retitled it The Knife. So I've been kind of aware of their influence on people and people saying, by God, if you saw them, it was so exciting. And that fusion of classical and rock at that point. And wasn't Lemmy, I think, their roadie at one point as well?
Maybe that's the point, that I think certain things are incredibly innovative at the time, but they do sound dated when you...
Well, this is it. I've only ever heard them years... You know, so I'd have probably heard The Nice for the first time in the 1980s or 1990s.
Mm.
And it didn't necessarily grab me. You know, I thought, okay, I can see the birth of something. I can see something interesting. That was it. I was glad I'd listened to it, but it didn't necessarily compel me to listen to it again and again. And you're right, the production seemed...
The production is very thin.
For the time. Very thin.
But I think that's it. The path of kind of fusing classical music with rock would have been well worn by the time you would have heard The Nice would have heard The Nice.
Yeah.
But at the time, perhaps an album like Ars Longa Vita Brevis would have sounded revolutionary. You know, here he is doing the Corellia suite with rock drums and rock bass, you know. But now it's been explored and it just sounds very dated and very gauche.
Even within a year, you know, Yes, who I think were quite influenced by The Nice,
yes,
their debut, which I think they fit into my Academy of the Underrated, and if they'd have just done their debut album, we'd
great
still
record.
Be talking about Yes,
love it.
And they go off in these tangents with occasional classical licks, which I assume are influenced by The Nice. Sounds great.
Yes.
And the Led Zeppelin album, you know, the debut, again, it sounds colossal. Mm. They are Led Zeppelin from their opening note onwards. Mm. And I don't know, The Nice sounded always very tentative to me by comparison.
Yes, I think they were forging, this category we've called progressive undercurrents. It's the idea, I think, is these are the artists that are laying the foundation for what would be progressive rock. And The Nice, absolutely, props to them, probably more so than any other artists on this list, maybe with the exception of Floyd, are laying the groundwork for what progressive rock will be, which, of course, as we've discussed before on the show, is very much about hybrids of rock and classical music, hybrids of rock and jazz, hybrids of rock and blues, hybrids of rock and folk music, and this idea of conceptual thought and the idea of expanding a piece of music beyond the 3-minute pop form. It's all there in The Nice. It's all there on this album.
Yeah.
It's an example of something as a kind of blueprint that other artists would take on and take to, including Keith Emerson himself, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, as you say, it's kind of, because again, I'd have probably only heard the debut Caravan album or debut Soft Machine album in the 1980s. So I'd have heard these around the same time I'd have heard the Nice album, but they stuck.
They stand up.
And they still stick.
They stand up.
And stand up, yeah.
Yes. And in a way, that should be no reflection on what we're talking about here. You know, at the time, these probably all seemed as revolutionary as one another. And who's to know what's going to date and what's going to date well and what's going to date badly? Who's to know, you know?
Mm.
So we are very much looking at these albums from the perspective, obviously, of 50, 55 years. You know, with the benefit of hindsight of all that time. And we can make these kind of, you know, judgments.
I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, again, I won't mention them in case they're listening in, but you know, there's a band I remember we saw in 1989 or 1990 one of the best live bands we had ever seen. The record came out, one of the biggest disappointments ever. It could not convey how original and exciting it was as a live experience.
I think I know who you're thinking about. I think I know who you're talking
about.
Yeah,
we saw them in Warrington, 1989.
Yeah, and they were brilliant.
It was amazing. It was a jaw-droppingly brilliant gig. Yeah. The album comes out, and it wouldn't have been the best album of the day. Of the day, even. It was underproduced.
It wasn't terrible, but it was such a... I know exactly who you're talking about.
And I wonder if the Nice were that they were electrifying with Emerson's showmanship. That's it. In a live context, it blows your mind, but somehow vinyl cannot capture
it. Didn't capture it. Anyway, for whatever reason, the Nice records, not the best, but, again, seeds of progressive music. Some other records, In Search of the Lost Chord, The Moody Blues, fantastic record.
Really good.
The first seven Moody Blues albums are just stunning.
They did do the R&B one just before, didn't they?
Well, I'm not... Yes, you're absolutely right. When I say the first seven albums, I'm forgetting the Denny Lane era Moody Blues album. I guess I'm talking about the Days of Future Past Through to Seventh. Yeah. So even they referred to Seventh Sojourn as their seventh album.
I know.
So they also dismissed the
I'm just being pedantic.
Very pedantic. No, but the listeners will be too. So it's good that you preempt the listeners being pedantic about it. The seven Moody Blues albums from Days of Future Past to Seventh Sojourn. Sometimes I forget which songs are on which album because there's so much of a piece to me. One of the greatest runs of albums ever made, I think, you know. Often people say, well, In the Court of the Crimson King wasn't the beginnings of progressive rock because the Moody, and I can see that argument, but the Moody's always had more of a pop sensibility, didn't they? Which I think...
No, this album does go off on quite a few tangents. A lot of poetry, a lot of sound effects.
Yeah, love it.
A lot of Mellotron.
Very pretentious in the best
possible
sense. Very
pretentious. I mean, you can definitely see the majestic ballad side of King Crimson.
Oh, completely.
Has already been...
Completely.
Formulated.
I Talk to the Wind could have been a Moody Blues
exactly.
song. Yeah, could have been. And Moonchild.
Even the title track, to an extent, could have been. I think King Crimson do it with a panache. And you know that, of course, they were signed initially, I think, to Threshold, weren't they? They were going to have Tony Clark as the producer.
Was it Tony Clark? Yes, I think you're right. Tony Clark, yes, yeah. The continuity on the albums are fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things I love about the Moody Blues albums is there's all those crossfades all the time. So you get this constant sense of journey, you get this sense of constant... But there isn't any sort of musicianship or shredding or... showing off on Moody Blues. And I use the phrase showing off in the best possible sense. I love the showing off on the Crimson records. But that's, I think, the difference with Crimson.
And I think with Crimson, when they show off with a passion. It's not just chops for chops'
Completely.
Sake.
Completely. Totally.
There's an intensity that maybe comes from Fripp's love of Hendrix. You know, there's a rawness to King Crimson's music.
Well, and Ian McDonald's love of, you know, Coltrane or
Albert Isler.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's all in Crimson. And there's none of that in the Moody Blues.
No, it's a great... I mean, I think this is their first great album. I think Days of Future Past, obviously, you know, Nights in White Satin is abnormally good. I think the album as a whole, again, it has that slight...
It's got
Odeon,
the orchestral... Yeah.
I'm not quite fond of the orchestration, and it does remind me, you know, once more of, buy your shoes from Batley's.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
There's an element of that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's a kind of incidental soundtrack to a sort of Britcom of the period.
I think the other thing that doesn't quite work so well about Days of Future Past is a lot of the time the orchestral passages are not integrated with the rock band. So you get, here's a little bit of orchestral music with some poetry over it. Okay, now the band are going to play you one of their songs.
Whereas this is fully integrated.
This is fully integrated,
I think you're right. I think from this point to Seventh Sojourn, there's not really a misstep.
Well, also, they've got rid of the orchestra and they've got the Tron.
They've got the Tron.
Lest we forget, the Moody Blues, one of the quintessential Tron bands.
It's gorgeous.
Along with Crimson. Yeah, and that's the other thing they have in common with Crimson, is they're one of the seminal Tron bands, you know. Soaked, as my friend Michael Ackerfeld would say, soaked in Mellotron.
It is soaked. A bit like my forthcoming solo album.
Tim's forthcoming solo album is soaked in Mellotron.
It is. It's very diverse, but it is soaked.
It's an orgy of Mellotron.
I would say it's an orgy.
an orgy of Mellotron.
But yeah, I really like this. I think it's one of the most inventive, quirky. In Justin Hayward, they've got a vocalist as good as any.
As good as Greg Lake, yeah. Pops. And again,
well, definitely as good as Greg Lake. Yeah. Great vocalist. And the others are good. I mean, the point is, they've got three really strong songwriters.
Well,
and
five, if you... Well, four. Okay, Graham Edge, who did the sort of poetry.
Yeah, but, yeah, well, this yeah. is it. They all... I think the problem they had is that Hayward... is one of the best vocalists of his era. They all could have made it separately. They're all great. And that's the problem, that almost everything is judged against yes. Hayward's greatness to an extent.
And the hits tended to be the ones yeah. that he sang and wrote.
Apart yeah. from Singer in a Rock and Roll Band, which I think was a John Lodge. Wasn't it? An enormous number. What's interesting is they were really big here, but they were particularly big in America.
Right.
For whatever reason, you know. Yeah. Again, it's uncompromising pretentiousness. Top of the charts.
But yes, and in that
living
sense,
the dream.
They are also a kind of anomaly, aren't they? They almost don't fit. It's like we talk about them as being progenitors of progressive music, but they don't really fit that. So they're very much out on their own, and perhaps they paid the price slightly for that. I'm not suggesting they're forgotten, but they perhaps haven't got their due over the longer period of time in terms of their influence and how they were really at the top of their game for about five or six years.
And ambitious, you know, and once we were saying... very prolific, yeah. but, you know, very lightly churning out great pop songs and pretentious conceptual works.
So we love the Moody Blues. A couple of other mentions in the sort of progressive undercurrents. Traffic's second album. A little bit of a step down from the first for me, but it's a good record.
I agree, yeah. Well, for me, they come into their own on John Barleycorn.
Yeah, well, I love that. I think, again, the first album is a classic. The Dear Mr. Fantasy is a classic of the psychedelic pop
Dave
era.
Mason is very good, I agree.
Shine On Brightly, Procol Harum, I'm not so familiar with.
This has got any songs we know on it? I think, hasn't oh,
the,
it?
The one of the earliest examples of a 20-minute long.
Yeah, that and Inagada Davida, although to be fair, right. it does a bit more than Inagada Davida does.
Inagada Davida is just a jam session with a drum solo in the middle.
I don't mind
no,
it.
No, this is more like, if correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not so familiar, this is more like a suite, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think, again, they churn, you know, Homburg... And What a Shade of Pale are probably my favourite moments ever by them. But I think Shine On Brightly comes pretty close. There are some great pieces on this. But I think that maybe their best album was Grand Hotel 72. I think that's a really strong record. You know, they continued to make great records. This one, it's funny. It's a bit like The Nice in that, bar the odd track, it's never imprinted itself fully on me.
Well, also, like the Moody Blues, they're kind of an anomaly, aren't they? They don't really belong to any particular genre you can identify. They just are Procol Harum. And as you say, they kept on making records and kept on having hits.
Good record. Yeah, hits good and
kept
good
on
records.
Having hits for many years to come. And yet they are largely remembered only for one song. Unfortunately for them, they're largely only remembered for
one. A Salty Dog.
Not A Salty Dog.
I love A Salty Dog.
Me too, yeah.
But what I think they managed to be is incredibly soulful, as well as having this slightly rarefied classical air. And what I hear in the best of early Procol Harum is bits of where Gabriel's Genesis are going and bits of Talk Talk, strangely. We've got to mention Talk Talk.
Well, I'm just going to say, you've managed to shoehorn Talk Talk to an episode where I really thought we were going to be struggling. But you've managed it, Tim. Well done.
Thank you. And I think that it's because Hollis has got this very earthy, soulful voice, as has Gabriel. Mm. And it's that kind of voice, like Brooker's. Mm. I think there's a lineage, Brooker, Gabriel, Hollis.
There's one artist that Tim...
Buchanan. I'm going to throw Paul Buchanan in there as well.
There is an artist that neither myself or Tim have managed to shoehorn into this episode yet, but I'm not going to say it because it would be self-defeating to mention.
Okay.
I just want to see if it naturally comes up.
Although, obviously, Kate Bush,
no,
she did use
she's
Gary
not the
Brooker.
Person I'm thinking of. No,
she's
not
the
person. She's not. No, this person, I've got a feeling... that, don't mention the name.
Okay.
I've got a feeling this person might come up when we start talking
all
about
right.
the Marble
well, Gary
Index.
Gary Brooker did appear on a Kate Bush album. But I think you can hear the kind of birth of Gabriel's Genesis, the birth of Talk Talk, and it's partly because of that combination of the earthy and the rarefied.